Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. A little confusion about this hour. My mistake. Jimmy Akin here with us for this hour again. Thank you for saving our bacon, Jimmy. We thought we had we're going a different direction, but we're not. So thanks for being here for another hour.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm
going to help out.
Well, I you always are, Jimmy. You're always good to us that way, and I do appreciate it. We continue with Ask Me Anything this hour. It'll be Jimmy as our guest, and you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Lots of people stayed on the line. I'm glad they did. I'm glad they didn't say, well, I can't talk to Jimmy, so I'll go. Because you do get to talk with Jimmy, and we'll go to Sherman, Texas, where Abram is listening on Catholic.com. Are you there with us, Abram?
Yes.
Hello, Abram. How old are you?
8.
Do you know we already talked to a kid from Sherman, Texas today?
No. Yes, that was your brother. Oh, yes.
Oh, that was your brother. Okay. I suspected as much since they sent me a note that said this is you're his 8-year-old brother. Well, we're glad you're here, Abram. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
If a person is martyred, do they automatically become a saint?
Well, so if someone gives their life for Christ, then yeah, they're going to be a saint. The question would be, do they go directly to heaven or do they need some purification first in purgatory? There is a pious belief, this is not church teaching, but there is a pious opinion that that they don't need to go to purgatory, that they would go straight to heaven. However, that's not church teaching, and so I prefer to leave it up to God whether they need purification or not.
Okay, Abram, does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, that sounded like that might be your mom there with you. If you put her on the phone, you don't have to. We already have your brother's address. We're going to send you one of the graphic novels. We sent your brother one. We'll send you one if that's okay with your mom. And thank you again for the call. We'll go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida now. Pat's in Fort Lauderdale, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Pat, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thanks very much. Hi, Jimmy. I'm a supporter of the Catholic Diocese of Fairbanks, Alaska, so I get their newsletter once a month. And I'm reading it, and I'm seeing that they've got so many backwoods, far-flung, in the middle of nowhere parishes with so few priests that sometimes these churches only see a priest every month or 6 weeks or whatever to have mass said. And I'm like, gosh, there's got to be some alternative for these people who are, through no fault of their own, you know, on the tip of civilization. So it got me thinking about the diaconate. And I wondered, is it possible, or is there any immovable impediment that says what deacons can do today is all they could ever do? Or is it possible that, you know, in extraordinary circumstances like the Fairbanks, Alaska diocese has, they don't have enough people to do mass. Is it theoretically possible that a pope could say, in extraordinary circumstances, when there are few alternatives, I'm going to allow a deacon, for instance, to say a mass, to hear confessions, to do weddings or whatnot, not as a matter of course, but as a matter of exception? Is it possible under any circumstance? That's my question.
Okay, so I got to bifurcate the examples you just named. Right now, deacons can do weddings, so that's not a problem. They can also do baptisms. When it comes to the other sacraments, though, and that's the same as anybody. Anybody could theoretically do a baptism in emergency circumstances. Anybody theoretically could witness a wedding for the church, but deacons are authorized to do both more regularly. In terms of the other sacraments you mentioned, the Eucharist and confession, that's been infallibly settled, and the answer is no. The Council of Trent indicated infallibly that you got to be a priest to do both of those. And so a deacon would not be able to do that unless he's ordained priest. Now, hypothetically, you know, we could have more priests, including, you know, people who had formerly been permanent deacons. They could be hypothetically elevated to the priesthood. Hypothetically, they could even do that if they're married, because the tradition in the Latin Rite of having unmarried priests is not a matter of doctrine. It's a discipline that the church had reasons for instituting, but in, you know, if the circumstances warrant, that discipline could be modified in some way. Also, what deacons can do, and again, this is not limited to deacons, but what deacons can do is communion services, where they don't consecrate the Eucharist, but they take the Eucharist from where it has been consecrated, and they bring it to areas where there's not a priest, and they distribute communion. And, you know, there's a ritual that goes along with that. In fact, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has actually published a book called Sunday Celebrations in the Absence of a Priest, which is for use on Sundays when there's no priest available to say Mass, and so someone else needs to be the one leading the communion service, and deacons are prime candidates for doing that.
And thank you very much for the question. I appreciate that. That was Pat in Fort Lauderdale. Thank you. That's quite a ways to get the newsletter from the Fairbanks, Alaska diocese in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Exact opposite sides of the country, but good for you for paying attention. Herb's in Tampa, Florida, watching on YouTube. Herb, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, thank you, and hello, Jimmy. First time I've spoken with you. I'm a returning Catholic after about 30 years, and been attending Mass daily in the mornings. And it's had a pretty good effect on my life. And the question I have is related to Eucharistic adoration. Mm-hmm. The church I go to currently has an oratory, which I guess is really just a chapel. And they do Eucharistic adoration on a day during the week from one period to another. But I can go into that chapel any time of the day, any day of the week, because it's open. And Eucharist is not on display, it's in the tabernacle. And mm-hmm. like growing up in the church, I know when the candle's lit to the right of the tabernacle, that means Jesus is present in the tabernacle. So my question is, what's the difference or the benefit to make an effort to go to the adoration when Eucharist is on display versus just being there in the presence, knowing that he's there in the tabernacle, either in that little chapel, or like when I was growing up, my grandmother used to take me to church, and we would do that exact thing in the church because he was there with the candle lit, and I knew that Jesus was there, and we would pray to him. So I just don't know what the benefit. I mean, obviously you can see it, but is one way better than the other, or
all right?
Does it make a difference?
Okay, so Herb, I got your question, and the basic answer is that it's Jesus either way. By exposing the Blessed Sacrament, taking it out of the tabernacle so that the faithful can see it, it may foster the devotion of some people in a greater way because they can see the host. But it's Jesus either way, and he's also hidden either way. He's either hidden under the accidents of bread, or he's hidden under the accidents of bread inside the tabernacle. So, you know, it's not like you're seeing, unless God does a miracle, it's not like you're seeing the physical body of Jesus. He's not appearing before you with arms and legs and stuff like that, but he is really there. Either way, he's really there. The difference is how vivid an experience of the Eucharist you have, and that's dependent on whether or not you can see it. If you're able to go to Eucharistic exposition and adore Jesus during exposition, that's great. But if that's not, you know, convenient for you, it's God is perfectly willing to accept your adoration of Jesus in the tabernacle, or with you in the oratory, or he's happy for you to be at home and adore Jesus in the tabernacle. Jesus is God, and so he's worthy of our adoration, regardless of where the host is located and regardless of where we're located. It's just a matter of what you personally find fosters your own devotion, whether, you know, and go into the church to adore Jesus in the tabernacle. That's a length you didn't have to go to. That's itself a sign of devotion. And go in at a special time when he's going to be exposed. That's another and even more special exercise of devotion that also has the benefit of letting you see the Eucharist, which may further foster your devotion.
Herb, thank you. It takes us right to the break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and you are welcome to call with your question, 888-318-7884. We're going to Rob in Rhode Island to start this hour, this segment off. Rob, watching on YouTube, thanks very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I really enjoyed the Focus podcast about the crucifixion date of Friday, April 3rd, 33 AD. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering, Jimmy, is that adjusted for Julian, or did you adjust for the Gregorian calendar?
It's standard when dealing with ancient dates to leave them in the format that they were originally in. So that date is actually on the Julian calendar. If you wanted to know what that corresponds to on the current Gregorian calendar, you'd need to add, you know, however many days it is at this point.
Okay, great, thanks. And actually, I had one more question, if I could. I have mm-hmm. the Bible as a Catholic book, mm-hmm. and something I'm just a little confused by. I was wondering if you could clarify. I'm still kind of early into it. On page 53, you say on the third paragraph there, it says, Jesus also didn't expect Romans to be expelled from Israel. On the contrary, he foresaw a war with the Romans, with Jewish forces being defeated and the temple destroyed.
Yep.
So to me, I'd never heard that before like that, because it sounds like Jesus was wrong about something. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you could explain that a little bit.
No, he wasn't wrong. So if you look, for example, in Mark 13 and in Luke 21 and in Matthew 24, Jesus predicts the destruction of the Jewish temple. And he says this is going to happen within a generation, and it did. He's saying this, you know, about AD 33, and there was a war with the Romans, and it beginning in AD 67, and the temple was destroyed in, or maybe 66, and the temple was destroyed in AD 70. So, you know, 37 years later, exactly what he said happened. So this was a fulfilled prophecy. And the fact that the evangelists don't point out that this was fulfilled is a sign that the Gospels were written before it was fulfilled, because they love recording when Jesus said something and it came true. And if they had been written after the destruction of the temple, then you would expect at least one of the evangelists to say, "Oh, and it happened just like he said," to show that he was a true prophet. But none of them said that, and that's a sign that the Gospels were written early, before the war had actually happened.
Rob, thank you. Thanks very much for the call. On we go. Greg is in Bismarck, North Dakota, listening on 91.7 FM. Greg, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Greg?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air with Jimmy.
Hi, I had a question on the Nephilim and if they were legitimate angels or fallen angels or beings and who they were and what they were.
The Nephilim?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, the passage in Genesis 6 where this comes from is a hotly debated passage. Now, what it says is that the sons of God took wives from among the daughters of men, and that apparently then the Nephilim were born to them, and they were on the earth at that time, which is before the flood, and it also says they were on the earth later too. So these days, because interpreters today are aware that angels don't have physical bodies natively, most interpreters today try to interpret the sons of God as human beings of some kind, either like the people from the wicked line of Cain, or people from the righteous line of Seth, or people from who were kings or priests or priest kings or something like that. So you get these different theories about who the sons of God are, but there are a couple problems with that. One problem is that the term sons of God is used in the Old Testament to refer to angelic beings. We see that at the beginning of the book of Job, where God's in heaven and the sons of God come in, and you know, and then Satan comes in too. And so you have this heavenly kind of courtroom scene where it's obvious the sons of God are angels. And that's an Old Testament usage. Now, in the New Testament, guess what? Humans get to become the sons of God, but that's not the usage that's normal in the Old Testament. So that's one problem. Another problem is if you say that that the sons of God are human, it's really just speculation about, well, who are they? Because you're inventing a usage that does not appear in the Old Testament. You don't have kings in general or priests in general called sons of God. You're just speculating on that. And it's not obvious why the daughters of men are then called the daughters of men if they're all humans here, because daughters of men would normally in the Old Testament mean these are human women. And sons of God in the Old Testament would ordinarily mean these are angelic beings. And that leads to the next problem, which is a big one, which is all of the ancient sources agree that the sons of God are angels. We have this in early church fathers. We have this in early rabbinic writings. We have this in Second Temple literature, like the Book of Jubilees and the First Book of Enoch, and all of the ancient sources interpret the sons of God as angels. Now, who are the Nephilim then? Well, you're going to hear a couple of theories. They're apparently born from the union of the sons of God with the daughters of men, and you're going to hear some people say that the term Nephilim is derived from a Hebrew term that means to fall. So the Nephilim are the fallen ones. But there's a problem with that, which is the grammar doesn't work. If you're taking the Hebrew word and turning it into for to fall, and you're turning it into something that should mean fallen ones, it ought to come out, if memory serves, as Nophilim rather than Nephilim. However, the term Nephilim is a perfectly straightforward word in Aramaic. It means giants. And that's how ancient interpreters took this. The authors of the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, they translated it gigantes, which means giants. Also, if you look in Jubilees and First Enoch, they also interpret it as giants. And so, for my money, the best interpretation of what this is depicting is angelic sons of God, maiden with human women, and given birth to giants. Now, how literal is this? Well, we're in the primordial history of Genesis, which, as Blessed Pius XII said in his encyclical Humanae Generis, communicates stuff about the history of the world, but in a way that doesn't correspond to the way modern historians write. Instead, he said it communicates information in a simple metaphorical way to a people but little cultured. And so you don't, even though that seems to be what this passage is depicting, you don't gotta necessarily take it literally. And there are other options too. I mean, St. Thomas Aquinas talked about how a demon, even though they don't have physical bodies of their own, how they could mate with a human woman in the form of a succubus or incubus. I always get those two mixed up. But basically, what would happen is a demon would impersonate a woman and mate with a man and get the germ cells needed from a man to impregnate a woman. And then it would gender bend and impersonate a man and have relations with a woman and use those germ cells to bring about a conception. And Aquinas points out that since the germ cells came from a man, the resulting conception is also going to be a man. But that's not to say that the angel couldn't manipulate the germ cells in some way, such as to produce a larger than normal human or a human with a bad disposition or something like that. So I can see ways that you could even take the passage literally and make sense out of how it works. I actually did episodes of Mysterious World on both of these issues. You can look up Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World Nephilim and also Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World Giants. And you can listen to the two episodes. And I also have a few episodes coming out this summer on the Book of Jubilees and on First Enoch. And you can get more background about the literature in the Second Temple period and what it had to say about all this.
Just check out mysterious.fm. Greg, thank you very much for the call. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour. Lisa is in Toronto, Canada, watching on YouTube. Lisa, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. So I'm not Catholic. I'm just reading off something I wrote down here, so please bear with me. My writing's a bit scratchy. I have recently inquired about getting an exorcism with my local archdiocese and was told I had to be Catholic. Do you have any advice on how to get help?
Well, so what you were told is not the Catholic Church's law. There is no requirement that that a person be Catholic in order to have an exorcism. In fact, I know of cases where non-Catholics have received exorcism from Catholic priests. My first thought about what to do would be contact an exorcist. And I don't know, you may have contacted the archdiocese, talked to someone in the office who was not fully informed about this matter, but I would try to contact an exorcist. Not necessarily one in your area. I mean, there are various exorcists who are, you know, in the public eye. They sometimes do interviews on YouTube and things like that. I would contact one of them and say, I'm here in Toronto, and I think I may need an exorcism. Can you refer me to an exorcist in my area that I could speak to, and then take it up with that person? And being an exorcist, they would be more informed about what the church actually requires. And consequently, you would have a better chance of being able to get an exorcism, that way than by talking to an office worker who's not fully informed.
Okay.
All right.
I'll try that out then. I do appreciate your time, and thank you very much for answering my question.
God bless you.
No
Lisa.
Problem.
Thank
and
you.
And if it doesn't work, give us a call back, because there are other things you could try too, but that's what I would try first.
Lisa, thank you. Dave is in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Dave, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, brothers in Christ. I heard an interview with a political talk show host, a real popular one. You would know if I said his name, with Stanley Marshall, about when Pope Benedict retired and the Vatican was struck by lightning. And I was also informed that there was a banking problem with the banks. And when Pope Benedict retired, the banking problem went away. So my question is, I wasn't in the church back then. Unfortunately, I confess that, so I'm forgiven for that. My question is, what was the mood with all the apologists? What were you guys saying back then?
Okay, so I think we're about to hit the break, so I may need to continue this on the other side. But in terms of the mood, well, I was disappointed when Pope Benedict retired. He is my favorite all-time pope, and so I'd hoped he would continue for many more years. Having said that, I respected his decision. I recognized that, you know, he obviously had serious reasons for what he did, and even though I was sad, you know, I respected what he did. But there's the music, and so I'll address the other two parts of your question on the other side of the break.
Hang on, Dave. We will be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's the groovy music. Jimmy Akin here with us graciously for a second hour today. And it's Ask Me Anything. If you've got a question, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Dave in Cincinnati wanted to know, what was the mood of the apologists here when Pope Benedict retired? Was there any reaction here to the, or did we hear about him? Was there any reaction to the lightning striking the Vatican and then something about a bank?
Yeah. So in terms of the second question, well, I was aware of when lightning struck the Vatican, and it was very dramatic. I saw a photo of it, and it's a very dramatic photo. What should we make of it? Well, one of the things that the church has rejected is seeking omens. You know, omen seeking is something that you do when you try to, when you look at events and try to discern messages that God or the gods are sending through nature. And this is not part of the biblical mindset. There are instances where someone in the Bible will pray for a sign, but the idea that God is constantly sending us messages through nature is not the biblical worldview. Whose worldview it was the Romans, the pagan Romans. I was very surprised the first time I read Suetonius's Lives of the 12 Caesars, and wow, they are doing omens all over the place. I was gobsmacked because it was so different from reading the Bible. But they saw all these different events connected with the lives of the Roman emperors as being of supernatural significance, you know, like this rooster chick got born without a comb, and that was a sign connected with this emperor. And this statue had lightning strike it, and it struck off the letter C, and that had supernatural significance. All this kind of stuff. It was, I read it, and I was just, wow, these guys were superstitious. Because that's what that is. That's superstition. It's attributing too much significance to something. And so, you know, the Vatican's been around for 2,000 years. They have lightning storms on the regular in Rome. At some point in the 2,000 years, lightning is going to strike the Vatican, because lightning tends to strike high things, and the top of the Vatican is a high thing. So it's not, it just happened to happen here, but I don't think we can say with any confidence that it had any kind of divine message to it. And even if it did, what the heck's the message supposed to be? I mean, you know, I know some folks want to claim that Benedict didn't really resign, but no, the evidence is he really did resign. He said so himself multiple times. And you could look at it another way and say, this is making the point that he resigned. You know, this is a big, huge heavenly exclamation mark going, bam, he's not Pope anymore. So, you know, even if you take it as an omen, which you really shouldn't, it's an ambiguous omen. And so you can't read a message out of it, because it can be taken more than one way. So one more reason not to take it as an omen, because you can't determine what it means. Then there, you mentioned a banking scandal, and there is an ongoing issue with the Vatican Bank. It's technically called the Institute for the Works of Religion, but it's popularly called the Vatican Bank, and it has not been historically in compliance with European banking regulations. And there has been a back and forth struggle trying to bring it into compliance that Pope Benedict was part of and Pope Francis is part of, and they've both been working to improve the situation with the Vatican Bank and to have it meet modern banking standards. Whether it's there or not yet is, you know, a question that people could have different views on. But I'm not sure what point was being made by whoever this was you were listening to, Dave, but it doesn't sound great to me. It doesn't sound like any, like a coherent, at least based on what you said, because I didn't hear the original. But based on what you said, I'm not seeing any obvious connection between these things.
Dave, thanks. On we go now to Phoenix, Arizona. Heidi, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Heidi, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you very much. My question is actually based on one of the previous callers about the Nephilim, specifically about 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 10, where Paul references women should wear head coverings because of the angels. In a million years ago, I used to listen to Dr. Heiser all the time. I'm sure you're probably familiar with him.
I knew Mike.
I would love your take on that.
Okay. Well, you may be aware of, so Michael Heiser was an evangelical scholar who unfortunately passed away recently. He was a nice guy. I knew him. In terms of his interpretation of this passage in 1 Corinthians, Heidi, I assume you know what his interpretation is. I'll recap it, but I'm going to do it very delicately because this is a family show. So thank you for not saying it as bluntly as it could be said. But basically, the proposal is that, so what Paul says is women should wear head coverings or have their hair cut off. And if they don't want to do one of those two things, and the reason he gives for wearing a head covering in church, it's not head coverings all the time, but the reason he gives for wearing a head covering in church is because of the angels. He also alludes to nature. Doesn't nature teach you this? Well, okay, so we got two things here. What would explain the nature reference, and what would explain the angels reference? Now, in terms of the nature reference, Mike and other scholars, this is not unique to Mike, but other scholars have pointed out that there was a particular view in Greek medicine at this time that held that when a woman has long hair, it will make it easier for her to have a baby. Not because she's going to attract a man or something like that, but there is a physical reason why a woman having long hair will make it easier to have a baby. And I'm going to say this very delicately, but the reason is they viewed hair as a set of small tubes that would attract the germ cells from a man needed to have a baby. And they would help those germ cells get to the part of the woman's body where the baby is conceived. Conversely, they believed that if a man had long hair, it would hinder him from becoming a father, because the hair is a bunch of little tubes in this view that will attract the germ cells, and that'll make it harder for him to get the germ cells to where they need to go to conceive the baby. And today, nobody believes this theory. You know, this is totally not how human biology works, but it was the best medical opinion of the day. You know, you had Greek physicians who thought this. And so the effect of that is going to be that the hair length of a woman becomes a secondary sexual characteristic. You know, it's if she's got long hair, that's a sign that she's fertile and ready to have a baby and stuff like that. And so so the question would then be, what does modesty say on this view? If people believe that having long hair is this sexual thing, do you want to be flaunting your secondary sexual characteristics in church, or do you want to be modest and cover them up? So that is a likely explanation for why he says either let her cover her hair or have it cut off, because then she won't have this she won't be flaunting this sexual characteristic in church. So it seems that this would explain the modesty aspects of what's going on here. And you know, frankly, this is one of the most mysterious passages in the Bible. But I think that this understanding of it is plausible. So what would that tell us about head coverings? Well, we're from a different culture. We don't have this theory, we don't have this medical theory, so it won't mean that to us. But in a culture where people believe this, well, you would want to cover up a woman's long hair so that you're not flaunting a sexual characteristic in church. That's just basic modesty, and so this would be how they understood modesty. So what about the angels part? Well, okay, the term angel means messenger, and hypothetically, this could be a reference to human messengers. And you might propose that that the pastor of the church could be considered the church's messenger or the church's angel, and having multiple pastors, if there were multiple ones. Well, having women flaunting their hair in, you know, a sexual characteristic in front of the church's pastors, well, that's not really a great idea. You know, the clergymen need to remain chaste, and flaunting something that's regarded as a sexual characteristic is not a great idea. So that's a possible interpretation, but the term angel normally doesn't refer to a human messenger. Normally it refers to an angelic, what we would call an angelic messenger, a spiritual creature from heaven. And that ties, and so you got to say, well, what would it mean in these terms? Well, okay, one possibility is St. Paul was afraid of what was reported to happen in Genesis 6 happening again. Because in Genesis 6, it says the sons of God mated with the daughters of women and gave birth to giants. And it says that the giants were on earth both then and later. And we have evidence from that later on in the Pentateuch, where the Israelites encountered descendants of these giants after the flood. So the logical way to explain this would be, okay, the sons of God mated with the daughters of women before the flood, and then they did it again after the flood. And so Paul might have a concern here that that it could keep happening. And if you got, you know, women in church being all sexy, and we know angels are looking in on church services, they could get tempted. And so that may be what Paul's thinking about here. Now, I know how wild that sounds, and it is pure speculation. I mean, it's got some grounding in some evidence. It's not purely untethered speculation. But all I can really do is sketch some of these possibilities for you, and you can make up your own mind, because none of this is church teaching. This is all a matter of interpretation, and people can and do have different opinions on it. But that's kind of Michael Heiser's understanding of this, and I don't think it's completely unreasonable. I think that it's possible that, you know, that could be what's going on in this text, but I don't think it's certain.
And Heidi, I will leave it there because we are at the break. Thank you very much for the question. I hope that was helpful to you. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin been kind enough to stay with us for 2 hours today. He was scheduled for one, but he rescued us for the second hour, and we're grateful for it, as I'm sure you are, especially those on the phone getting ready to get their question answered. It's Ask Me Anything, and up next is John in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube. John, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. Is my connection clear?
Yes.
You're fine. What's your question?
Oh, perfect. I'm so excited. I listened to your debate with Dr. White on purgatory, and mm-hmm. he mentioned that you can go to Mass, or you can be perfected through the Mass, but then that night you can commit a mortal sin and go to hell. So my question is, like, as a new convert, like, mm-hmm. in what sense do we have peace with God?
Well, we have peace with God in the sense that we're not at war with God. Now, if we choose to go to war with God by committing a mortal sin, well, then we don't have peace anymore. But as long as we aren't at war with God, we've got peace with him. We've got, you know, we've been justified, so we have positive relations with God. That's the biblical sense of peace. And I don't know if you've seen the full debate, but I address, I haven't debated purgatory with James White. I debated him recently on Sola Scriptura and on how to have peace with God. And at the end of the peace debate, which is really a justification debate, you know, he's raised this question in his closing statement, and I respond to it. He's got this rhetorical tactic of how can we possibly have peace with God if it's even remotely possible that we could turn our back on God and reject him? And it's like, dude, do you know what the term peace means? I mean, this is an established term. Right now, you know, and Israel is not at peace because it's got tense relations with various neighbors. So it doesn't have peace in the biblical sense. It also doesn't have peace in the modern sense because it's at war with Hamas. But you know who does have peace? And I point this out in my closing statement of this debate. The United States and Britain have peace. you know, we've got good, positive relations. In fact, even though we threw off the shackles of our British overlords, no offense to our former British overlords, we've got a great relationship. It's even referred to diplomatically as the special relationship because of how great we get along. Well, okay, so they have nukes and we have nukes, and hypothetically one of us could launch a nuclear attack on the other tonight, but we don't want to do that. We've got good relations, and so we have peace with Britain, both in the military sense and in the sense of positive relations. So the idea that you need some infallible certainty that you will never, under any circumstances, have a deterioration in relationships in order to have peace is just not how the word peace is used. So what James White's done is try to force an unnatural, hyperbolic usage of the term peace that does not correspond to the way it's used either in the Bible or in modern language onto this term. He's effectively inflated it to mean something it just doesn't mean. So we can have peace with God because he's justified us, he loves us, we love him, and as long as we don't go to war with him, those positive relations are going to continue.
And I'm going to leave that there. John, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you for the question. Maddie's in Ohio listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Maddie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, hi there. How are you doing tonight?
Very well. Thank you.
All right. So I have a question. I'm an adult child of a divorced family. So I was looking into, you know, a friend of mine had suggested resources about that because she was just concerned about me. Mm-hmm. And she suggested Life-Giving Wounds. And I'm like, I understand that my parents got divorced when I was a kid, but a lot of the stuff just isn't resonating. Like, I understand that divorce is not a good thing and that usually it's a problem and stuff like that, but it just, I don't know if I just don't connect the same way to the divorce that other people do that are the children of an adult children of divorce. I don't know where the disconnect is happening. Because it's like, I know divorce is bad. You shouldn't be getting divorced unless you absolutely have to. But at the same time, it's like, I'm not connecting the same way to the situation as a lot of these other resources I'm looking at are.
So you wanted to ask Jimmy what?
So, Maddie, what's your question for me?
The question, like, has to do with, like, just, I don't understand why divorce is such a big problem, I guess, especially for, like, the kids of the divorce. Because it's like, I'm not the one who got divorced. My parents were. So.
Yeah. Well, so if that was the understanding that you had at the time that your parents got divorced, I'm very sorry to hear that they did. But then that's something that would have helped you cope with it. And you're right. It's not that you didn't cause them to get divorced, but a lot of children have a concern about it. You know, a lot of children feel like one of their parents is abandoning them. Or they feel like maybe they caused the divorce because a lot of kids, you know, kids act up and their parents get frustrated and they might blame themselves for their parents getting divorced. So that's part of why divorce is a problem, because very frequently does have a negative emotional impact on the children who either feel abandoned or even that they are at fault for their parents getting divorced. You know, maybe if I'd been a better child, if I'd obeyed them better, maybe they would have stayed together. And so a lot of kids think that way. That's not a mature way of thinking, but a lot of kids do. Another kind of damage that divorce does to the children is it can communicate the idea that divorce is an okay, easy thing to do. There is a pattern that has been observed of children who grew up in divorced households going on to have a higher rate of divorce themselves because they've seen their own parents not stay together, and that makes it easier for them when they encounter a problem in marriage, and everybody encounters problems in marriages, to bail and imitate what their parents did and get out of here. So that's the second problem with it. Fundamentally, humans require 2 decades to grow to maturity, and having two parents helps. If you look at life outcome studies and so forth, of children who grow up with two parents versus one parent, the children with two parents do way better. That's because that's the natural design of things. God designed human parents to stay together on a permanent basis so that they could raise their children, because our children are more intelligent than other animals. They have these freaky huge craniums, and they need to come out of a very small opening, which means they have to be born very young, and they're very helpless. They're not like baby deer. You know, you watch a baby deer getting born, it plops out, and within minutes, it's up and running. Well, our offspring are incredibly vulnerable. They cannot take care of themselves in any way when they're born. And it takes us, because of how immature we are when we're born, it takes us basically 2 decades to grow to maturity. And with parents having multiple kids, that means the parents need to stay together for decades and in order to properly care for our offspring. Is it possible to raise a child without two parents? Well, yeah, it is possible, but that doesn't mean it's the ideal. The way human nature is designed, it's designed for parents to stay together for decades in order to raise their offspring together. And so divorce circumvents that process from happening and ends up harming the offspring. It also ends up harming the parents, because, you know, there may be some cases where and there are cases where, for a legitimate reason, the parents need to separate. But in a lot of cases, a lot of spouses feel abandoned when their wife divorces them or when their husband divorces them, and they feel totally abandoned. And so they may try to put a good face on it, but a lot of them experience abandonment feelings. They encounter financial hardships. They encounter all kinds of things. They encounter jealousy. You know, when the husband gets a new trophy wife, or you know, when the wife gets remarried to somebody else, and it's like, why does she love this guy when she made a commitment to me? This is a messy situation. And so I'm glad to hear that your experience with it, Maddie, was not as traumatic as it is in many cases. But these are some of the concerns that that may be motivating some of what you're reading in these resources. Does that help?
Hang on, Maddie. I put you on hold. I apologize. Does that help you, Maddie?
Oh, yeah, that does help a bit. Yeah, because I might have just gotten affected differently because, like, I knew ultimately it wasn't, like, my sibling and mine fault for what happened. But, yeah, I just, you know, it's like trying to look through these resources, it just felt like I was hearing the same kind of story over and over, and I'm like, this just doesn't resonate with what happened with me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you were okay, but those are some of the considerations that impact some other folks.
Paul in Oklahoma. Thank you, Maddie. Paul, can you be really quick with your question, Paul, then we'll get you an answer?
Yes. Hey, thank you so much.
Like really quick,
so
Paul.
I got a question. Yeah, I got it, got it. So question is about the Acts 3:5-3, Sapphira and Ananias dying, and in the context of Luke 12:10, about the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. If it kind of comes in the context of conversation with some Protestants who believe, like, okay, hey, they didn't die because they blasphemed, because they just lied. So this is not equivalent to blasphemy. But the second question, why they died? And he thinks, oh, because they believed, they justified, so God just didn't want them to die.
Okay, Paul, you're leaving Jimmy with 30 seconds.
Okay, so lying to the Holy Spirit, which is what happens with Ananias and Sapphira in Acts, is not the same thing as blaspheming the Holy Spirit, which the church understands to be basically a refusal to repent of sin. Now, in terms of why Ananias and Sapphira died, well, this is an exceptional circumstance. It happened when the church was very young, and they did lie to the Holy Spirit, but other people have lied to church officials and not had this happen. So I would propose that the reason an exception was made in this case was because of how young the church was, and this incident set a precedent to show people what not to do in the future.
And you can hear the music. That means we are done. Jimmy, thank you for the first hour. And then for the second hour, appreciate you being
no
here both
problem.
Hours.
Yeah.
Hey, if you want to find out if Frankenstein's monster would have had a soul, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It drops tomorrow. A new episode drops tomorrow. And there's more than 300 other episodes. Check them all out at mysterious.fm. That will do it for us. We'll see you next time. Oh, by the way, flannel panel tomorrow. So we'll see you for that, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.